for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 25 years ago, Tom Wolfe published his first novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, but he drew on the journalistic principles of his previous books. He portrayed 1980s New York as a hotbed of racial and cultural tensions, where Wall Street traders thought of themselves as masters of the universe. For this month's Reader's Review, how the novel has held up. Joining me, Juan Williams, political analyst for Fox News and author of Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. Kate Lehrer, she's author of Confessions of a Bigamist. And William Cohen, he's contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. I hope you'll join us. This is one of my favorite novels. Call us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Welcome.
Good to see you all. Juan Williams, in the prologue, Tom Wolfe sets this political landscape of New York City in the 1980s with racial, ethnic tensions. Talk about what's going on.
This is a wonderful moment in New York in that Wall Street has come back from the doldrums of the 70s, if you will. But Wall Street is bubbling. People are making big money. And the class divisions in the society that is New York City could not be more evident. You got everything from the squeegee guys who are wiping windows being told they no longer can wipe the windows, and there's tensions there with the mayor, an unnamed character in this novel, Bonfires. But then you've also got, the kinds of racial tensions, the Al Sharpton type stuff going on. You've got Howard Beach, where a black man was killed, and Gravesend, where another black man was killed. And these tensions then are all boiling into headlines in the tabloids, and the tabloids play a key role as well in this Bonfires. And then you have, on top of that, a sense of kind of just, you know, I mean, I think this is captured in some other fiction works of the time. I'm thinking back to Wall Street, the Oliver Stone movie. I'm thinking back to Liar's Poker, and I'm thinking back to Barbarians at the Gate, which all gives you a sense that, you know, there's this tremendous wealth, but then there's this other group of people out there, and they're mostly black, mm-hmm. Hispanic, but mm-hmm. also working class people who are resentful, envious, but angry about what's going on Wall Street. And somehow the people on Wall Street consider themselves masters of the universe. They're better than all these people who are so jealous and envious.
And Kate Lehrer, you've got the mayor being heckled, and he is furious.
Oh, yes, because, again, what is matters to all these people is their power. And he has more power than anybody else, or wants to have more power, or thinks he still does have more power, though of course he doesn't, and which is wonderful, though. You see those power plays all the way through this novel. He can't stand it that he cannot control all these different things, because you're now just going into the whole racial thing that had not really, well, had been there certainly since the 60s, but really the early 70s when it really broke loose. And it's just moving on. Maybe all that's changed are a few of the players today.
And William, you actually worked on Wall Street for 15 years. You also worked at GE Capital. I mean, what was the feeling like? Did this novel ring true to you?
I mean, that's the incredible thing, Diane, how true it does ring, even now, today, even with Wall Street being taken down a considerable peg after the financial crisis. I mean, back then, because that's exactly when I started on Wall Street, and You know, the bond traders were really, we can't say it on public radio, but they were really macho and very taken with themselves. And so Sherman McCoy is a perfect embodiment of that. And I remember in 1987, when I first started on Wall Street, there was a guy by the name of David Wittig, who was on the cover of Fortune magazine. He was a young guy, probably 31, 32, and he very handsome, had cufflinks, beautiful French cuffs, and smoking a big cigar, talking about how making $500,000 a year, which is, of course, one of the touchstone figures that Sherman McCoy and his bond traders want to make, how that wasn't enough money. And I'm thinking to myself, my goodness, you know, I cannot believe this. And then along comes, you know, this book and, you know, captures that whole spirit perfectly.
And Sherman McCoy is at the center, or one of the centers of the novel. He has a wife who is very interested in decorating her apartment, in making sure that everything is absolutely perfect. He has a six-year-old daughter whom he adores, but he's not satisfied. He's got a mistress on the side.
He's got a mistress. He's got the Park Avenue duplex. He's got this life that's, but it's dominant. I mean, he is a master of the universe in the sense that he has so much money. But at the same time, it's so fragile. And I think the critical moment in this book that everyone will remember is that he's just on the road with the mistress when he takes the wrong turn on an expressway in the South Bronx. And there he encounters people who are not so easily controlled as the very controlled environment on Wall Street.
And when he makes that wrong turn, Kate, his life changes completely.
Yes, it does. He says the wrong turn. In fact, he says the wrong turn, and the mistress says, "Sherman, it's the wrong turn. You've made the wrong turn." He still won't admit what's happened, but then, of course, that's just before he goes. There's the kill, which I call it, when he actually it's Maria.
It's
who
Maria
hits. It's
who's
Maria,
driving
the mistress.
His mistress.
Who ends up hitting the boy. To Sherman's credit, he does want to, well, a little credit. Give him a little, not much. He does want to report it.
Of
this
course.
This comes out of the way he was brought up. And the mistress says, "You have no idea. You don't know how to deal with that world." And, of course, he did not know how to deal with criminal cases at all, and he would have been in it. She understood. She had come out of the South, but she had made her way by marrying rich men, old men preferably, I think.
She was in her 30s. She married a much older, richer guy. But the point of the novel being that he does make a wrong turn, and whether he's a master of the universe or not doesn't matter anymore.
Well, I'm often fascinated by agendas derailed, if you will, and I think this book really captures that idea very well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this guy thinks he's in total control of his life. He's the best bond trader at the, you know, his firm. You know, he's, you know, I found it was, you know, he talks about insulate. Remember that great phrase, which just sticks in your mind. He was in this bubble, and he didn't think anything could change that. Yes, he had a big mortgage. Yes, he had a mistress, but he had everything ordered perfectly. And then he goes to the South Bronx, makes the wrong turn, hits the boy, and, you know, the whole agenda is derailed. And Wolf captures so well the feeling of what it was like to be in New York and the South Bronx at that time.
Talk about the South Bronx and how it contrasts with the life that Sherman lives.
Well, you couldn't imagine the distance because they're not that far apart if you're just doing geographical measurement. But in fact, in terms of life, Henry Lamb, who's the boy that gets hit, lives in the projects in the South Bronx. And he's barely getting through school and surrounded by criminality and vermin and all the rest, if you want to just in your mind, create the image, as Wolf does, of squalid public housing in New York City versus the kind of luxury that Sherman McCoy enjoys on Park Avenue with and his fancy car and his life. So at the time, and I think this is important to remember as well, you have things like Bernard Goetz taking place, where you have this kind of anger at the poor in New York. Bernard Goetz, who shoots some boys on the subway who he thinks were threatening him, becomes a hero, kind of representing the idea that, you know, white America is putting up with the threats and intimidation from these poor blacks. But of course, on the other side is Henry Lamb, who's a real person, and he's really trying to make his own way in the world. And he, much like actually much of the working class New York, black, white, Hispanic, whatever, thinks, gee, these guys on Wall Street are a bunch of arrogant asses, you know? I don't know if that's public radio language, but, you know, and they think they're better than everybody else. And, you know, we can talk in terms of the blacks, the Hispanics, and the working class in New York versus Wall Street. But, you know, it's interesting when you read this novel to see the place of women in this novel, which is that Sherman McCoy is not exactly on equal terms. Today, here in 2012, women have so much more power and status. But back then in 88, this was like, you are my trophy plaything. And even his wife withdraws her affections and the like after she discovers the mistress. But she, too, is just in charge of the duplex, in her place.
And the boy, Henry Lamb, is considered a, quote, honor student because he shows up every day.
That's all it takes.
And that's all it takes. And we're going to take a short break here. I do invite you to be part of this Reader's Review as we talk about Tom Wolfe's wonderful, fabulous novel, now 25 years old. What's the title?
The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right back. And we're talking about Tom Wolfe's novel, Bonfire of the Vanities, now 25 years old, but still as relevant today as it ever was 25 years ago. I have a story to tell you about Tom Wolfe when he was on this program several years ago. And, of course, he came in his beautiful white suit. We had advised him, of course, to please turn off his cell phone rather than doing so. He left it on, and during the program, the phone rang. And Tom Wolfe answered the phone and began talking on the air to whoever was on the other end of the phone. He said, oh, I'm on the Diane Rehm show. I'll have to talk to you a little later. I mean, he was so in the moment. He was so himself always. And I wondered about phrases like masters of the universe and the X-ray female, his wife, who is so thin you can see right through her.
Well, she exercises all the time. And the social X-rays not only starve themselves, they exercise all the time. Great for a man, too, but not these women. And, of course, he's looking for ways to justify the affair. Therefore, his wife, who is all of 40 years old or going to be 40, is over the top. And why can she understand? Why could he not just come out and say, well, I am a master of the universe and deserve to have a young, lush thing in my life? Which he does as he's struggling with the dog in that first scene that he's got to look for an excuse, you know, for taking the dog for a walk so he can go around the corner and be with his mistress.
And he goes out in the pouring rain. He wants to call his mistress, and what does he do? He makes a mistake, and he calls his own wife.
He calls his own wife, and of course, he thinks that he can talk his way out of it
because he's a master.
Because he's a master of the universe. And by the way, I just have to say, can you imagine though how different it would be? I mean, this was a time before cell phones, right?
Yeah.
Before iPhones, and he had to go to a payphone on the street and fumble with coins and put it in, and then he dials his number by mistake. Now he. You know, I suppose now there'd be even a more complete and more detailed record that the FBI would probably want to look at.
Of course.
And maybe it was a little harder when it was a payphone. But then, you know, he calls his mistress and he goes over there and tries to explain to her how he's made this mistake of calling her, his own home and asking for her. And she's completely uninterested in any of that. And then since he's there, of course, he might as well, you know, go through with what he came to do anyway. And, you know, 45 minutes returns home and tries to talk his way out of it.
And his wife does not believe him. Talk about the Reverend Bacon, William, because he is another huge figure in his book.
Yeah, and this prompts me to have a little story about Tom Wolfe, if I may. I mean, I was trying to, in my mind, remember the sequence of when. But I ran into Tom Wolfe on the street. I think it was probably 87, 88. And so this book had come out, and I'm trying to remember when exactly, you know, Al Sharpton and the whole Tawana Brawley thing was. I mean, by the way, it's amazing to think that now the Reverend Al Sharpton has his own cable TV show, but it come from being a reverend. And I remember bumping into Tom Wolfe on Madison Avenue, resplendent in his white suit and his hat. Here was an idol. I mean, this guy, of course, was an incredible journalist.
Fabulous.
And an incredible writer. And he made this transition to a novelist. And I said to him, I cannot believe how prescient you were in writing this about, you know, the reverend and the, you know, I think it must have been around Tawana Brawley or something like that was going on. And he looked at me and he said, yes, I do seem to have captured something, didn't I? And I thought that was so wonderful. And you're right. He was living in that moment and so of himself that, you know, he understood that he had accomplished something quite magical.
So what does the Reverend Bacon do, Juan?
Well, the Reverend Bacon seeks to exploit the moment and seeks to make money off of it. He's a guy who has a lot of, what would you call them, phony organizations and groups that are all about extorting money out of big white corporations, out of the Sherman McCoy type people who will write it off and say that they are so generous to the those in need. But, of course, Reverend Bacon's take, I think the name Bacon, of course, suggests pork, right? And what you see here is kind of pork barrel. This is the way that the minority reverend is going to make his way in the world. Not exactly a man of God, but a man who is very aware of his own bank account. Everybody's got their hand in the trough. And that's the way he makes his way in the world.
Okay.
Well, I think it all speaks to whoever these characters are. The only really good character is Campbell, the little girl, and she's beautifully drawn, too. But all these others, on the whole, they're after either fame or money, preferably both, and it all goes back to power. And each person has his or her own way to get that to that power, to that get to that ultimate aphrodisiac.
And that,
but money's huge in that
world. And
that
includes both Larry Kramer,
yes,
who's the assistant district attorney, and Sherman McCoy.
Yeah,
in,
they
in
all
a sense.
Are bound.
Absolutely.
They're all different sides of the very, of they both, they all refract from the same stone, and the same stone is power.
Do you agree?
Well, I do agree. And, you know, it's, again, he's, talk about prescient. I mean, this idea of the ambitious, you know, in this case, he was an assistant DA. But, I mean, you know, I mean, it could have been tightly drawn from Giuliani, who was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District at that time, when there were all sorts of talk about, you know, now we're reliving insider trading yet again with Preet Bharara in the Southern District of New York. But 25 years ago, of course, Rudy Giuliani was doing the same thing. This ambitious U.S. attorney, politically ambitious, trying to take advantage of the situation. The same thing was going on in the novel. And just one thing Kate said about Campbell, you know, I was struck in that scene early on where he's taking her to school, and he's, of course, feeling very good about himself being a father, which is, of course, ridiculous, but maybe, you know, typical of the time. And she looks up to him and said, you know, or something like, what if God doesn't exist? And it was such, again, just sort of this harbinger, because you knew that she was the only one asking the real question here, because clearly it was going to be the case that Sherman McCoy, you know, his whole world was going to fall apart, and so there was no God, you know, for him, or no God looking out for him, that's for sure.
You know what? You know what struck me, if I have a moment, Diane,
sure,
is the reporter, because that's what I do for a living. And the reporter is Peter Fallow.
Right.
And Fallow may be a key word here for our audience.
Right.
But, you know, this is an interesting moment, because Peter Fallow is just out for a story, and he's totally into the kind of sensationalism that you see in the New York tabloids. The owner of the paper, Sir Gerald Stein, and again, there's a lot of anti-Semitism that plays through this novel, like a lot of anger at Jews. And he is Jewish and British, and he is, you know, seen as a dummy by Peter Fallow, that he's just out there making money, but he's a know-nothing. He doesn't understand what, and they're all just in it, you know, for what they can get. So the thing that strikes me is, I don't know, I hear from Bill that, you know, Tom Wolfe thought he was prescient. But, you know, I think what it is that he was just a good journalist. And I think that's the problem with Tom Wolfe, is that people who are actual novelists don't like Tom Wolfe. Not to this day, 25 years later, that if you are talking, you know, to the great novelist of our time, Updike, if you're talking to Norman Mailer, they really deride Tom Wolfe.
Really?
They can't stand him. And then Tom Wolfe, in response, because they didn't like some of his subsequent novels even more than they didn't like Bonfires, then he wrote a letter called My Three Stooges, which was about, and so, I mean, but, you know, I think, and Wolfe thinks of himself in the tradition of Steinbeck or Balzac with the human comedy, and kind of recreating or capturing, more than prescience, capturing the excesses and realities of the time. And if you look at this novel, what's great to me about it is the details. It takes you back into the 80s.
Yeah.
And you can see specific details and telling moments that capture that time. For me, it feels like, gee, the 80s weren't that long ago, but I'm an old man at this point.
Well, I think, too, and his scenes are so, they stay with you so well. They're so brilliantly drawn. Some of them you could say, yes, they're set pieces. I mean, you could write that and link it or not link it to the novel. But the fact is, they're gorgeous, to the point that, having not read the book in 25 years, when I picked it up, before I opened it, I thought, okay, what do I remember? What are the most vivid scenes? Well, that first one, The Wrong Turn, right there, you can never forget that. Another one was at a dinner party where he's nobody, because all he does is make money, and he's with the glitzy names who are in the arts and have other things to recommend them, not his old New York crowd, the more sedate crowd. And then that last, when he's going to jail and in the jail. Fortunately, I couldn't remember the end, and I thought that was really good. I could remember all these things. But the way he describes that, I know that how they feel about him, and I was once at one of the dinners in New York, you know, one of the literary dinners right after he had won whatever he had, and then he was getting up and giving the speech that night in front of all the literary lions. Nobody would shut up. he spoke, and everybody kept talking, which was such a sign.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know, John Irving says that he just yaks, that he's a bad writer. It's like reading a bad magazine article, that he can't create characters, that he can't create situations.
Well, in his dreams.
Yeah. But John Irving. He says that basically what Wolf does is create. Wolf doesn't get into the internal drama in the way that most novelists do. He's talking about the larger social picture. And that's, but Diane, I think that's to Tom Wolfe's credit.
I agree with that completely. I mean, his journalistic eye is exquisite. I mean, and it was in his earlier nonfiction, The Right Stuff, The Painted Bird. I mean, those nonfiction books were fabulous. But as somebody who worked on Wall Street during this time,
he
captured what it was all about. It's extraordinary.
I want to read you this from our website. Someone writes, I'll never forget the scene where Sherman is attending a child's birthday party. The children start asking what the parents sitting around the table do for work. He tries to explain how he acquired a fortune by getting tiny commissions on multi-million dollar financial trades. Using the analogy of crumbs falling off a piece of cake to symbolize his earnings, it suddenly sounds ridiculous to the children and everyone else, and an activity that obviously provided nothing of use to the larger society. His child is envious of one of the other fathers who simply builds furniture. Boy, does that capture it.
And an indictment of today.
Exactly.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take calls now. Other people want to be part of the program. 800-433-8850. First to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Maggie.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
You know, I loved this book, too. One of my favorites. I didn't get around to reading it till about 3 years ago, but it was so realistic of how New York City was back in the late 70s, early 80s. I had occasion to travel there to visit a lot in those days, and you always felt like the place was on a precipice, ready to go into the abyss or something. And he's so captured that, and also the way he depicts these masters of the universe, I just think he nailed them too. It's still true today. They're just like that. So,
do you agree that the same holds true?
I mean, Diane, I've written 3 books about Wall Street. I worked on Wall Street for 17 years. When I go to college campuses, you know, after what we have been through, you would think the students there would sort of be willing to step back and rethink a career on Wall Street. But, you know, all of the drama and the excitement of being on Wall Street that he captures in this book, 25 years later, despite what we've been through, people still come up to me and they say, can you help me get a job at Goldman Sachs? Can you help me get a job here? It still has an allure that Wolf captures so beautifully.
To Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Hi there.
I just have a quick comment, and I'll take my response off the air.
Sure.
But I actually just finished this book a few weeks ago. I bought it at a thrift store for a quarter, and it's one of the best quarter I ever spent. But so look on the back cover, you know, so many of the reviews talked about it. It's so funny and just a real ride. And for me, I didn't really see that much humor. I thought the overall tone was very depressing, and for me, it was right there with like Lie Down in Darkness or like a Richard Yates novel. I mean, the picture it paints of New York in the 80s is just overall very depressing.
What do you think, Kate?
Well, I see the humor in it because I guess I like very dark humor. So I could, as long as I saw it that way and I saw what he was doing. And when you see people that care so, who are just totally consumed by hubris, by pride, and their sense of themselves, and making fools of themselves finally because they're so caught up in their own illusions. Most of these men in this novel are very delusional about themselves. They just simply are that way. So I could see the humor. I think the thing is, it's like any good humor, that you see the darkness and you get that, and then suddenly you have to stop laughing and thinking, you're appalled.
Wow. Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
horrible.
What about you, Juan? Do you think it was more funny or more tragic?
Well, when I first read it, I thought, because I don't know Masters of the Universe, they're not in my Washington political world, and it's not
but
to say...
But surely there are Masters...
Oh, no, I was going to say, I know some jerks, but I think that's of a difference. I mean, remember, the people here in Washington, they kowtow to the guys on Wall Street. The guys on Wall Street have the money, they fund the campaign. So in my world, they are the Wall Street guys do have a different level of status, and status is very important in this book. But I was thinking, as I was listening to the caller, about the tradition, the literary tradition that Wolfe occupies. Because I mentioned earlier Balzac, but you think then of more contemporary people like Jack Kerouac, if you will. And when you read those novels, you always come away thinking, this is kind of sad.
Political analyst Juan Williams. Short break. Right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
What's happening in Israel, Gaza, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Iraq, it's all interconnected with a lot of shifting and paradoxical alliances that are difficult to explain. Which is why on the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group's Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Join us.
Welcome back. Just before the break, Juan, we were talking about the tragedy versus the comedy.
Well, I think, you know, the human condition can be very comic. But when you get into human motivations and you start to see how prosaic and just at times greedy and awful people can be in their primary motivations, that's when it gets sad, because then I think the psychological answer occurs to you. These people are fallow. These people are kind of in a wasteland, you know. And so it's comic to see them act out, you know, the Reverend Bacon as this kind of greedy guy he's supposed to be representing the great civil rights movement tradition, and he's a minister. And in fact, he's acting out of pure greed and malice at times. And you just think, how is this possible? But the point I was making to you was, you know, in the great literary tradition that I think that Tom Wolfe really captures in Bonfire of the Vanities, you go back over time and you start to see some darkness, Diane. I mean, there's
no question.
Edgar Allan Poe, I think, also is a guy who wanted to model himself on Balzac. Certainly Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, that's a pretty dark, you know, pretty dark piece. I think of Dickens, you know, you can read Dickens and you can say, oh, this is really London at that time. This is society and poverty. But it's pretty grim. And if you, you know, you can laugh at moments, but at other times you're just appalled.
I personally cannot say I know anyone who fits this kind of mold. Truly. I mean, of a Sherman McCoy?
Well,
but you met
them. Well, I'm looking at you, you know, with three eyes, because, of course, in New York, even to this day, there are people like this. And my second book, which was about the collapse of Wall Street, the subtitle was A Tale of Wretched Excess and Hubris on Wall Street. And you know, hubris is very much, which is the, you know, if any word captures Sherman McCoy, it's hubris. And that is such a fundamental trait of human nature. And Wall Street, because it is such a Darwinian environment, you know, for you, we used to have an expression on Wall Street, it's not enough for you to win, others have to
lose.
Fail, others have to
sure.
lose. And so it's such a zero-sum game. And Sherman was, of course, always thinking that way.
I'm feeling very naive right now. Let's go to Indianapolis. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hey there. It's a great show.
Thanks.
I wanted to come. I was thinking of another tension that old Sherman had to deal with all the time, and that was his father-in-law, I believe it was, who was the lion of something. He was an old-time Wall Street guy that thought Sherman, and as a bond trader or whatever, was just kind of a hustler and a grifter and wasn't really legitimate either. So he had to deal with that in his own family. Which
was it his father or father-in-law?
Was it his father-in-law, I thought?
No, it was his father, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Right, but he was the...
That makes it even worse.
The lion of something or other?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Let me just say, Diana, I think this was very, Tom Wolfe did his homework incredibly well, because this was a whole generational shift on Wall Street from the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, when the banker, the investment banker, was the revered figure like his father. And then in the 80s and the 90s and even today, although a little less today because of what we just went through, but even today it's the trader who makes huge sums of money. Like, you know, Goldman Sachs, you know, I know how they make 10% of their money, and this is a firm I've studied, but I don't know how they make 90% of their money, because they make it from trading and this black box. And these traders became extremely powerful on Wall Street. And Wolf just captured at that moment when the shift was taking place. And you see it between the father and the son. It's beautiful.
You know what's interesting to me, again, watching, having just gone through this political campaign, is in the 80s, Mitt Romney was a master of the universe.
Very much
Barack
so.
Obama was the community organizer at the time. They could fit into Bonfire of the Vanities.
Wow. To Thetford Center, Vermont. Good morning, Maura.
Oh, Diane, I am... so excited, I literally had to lie down on my couch because I thought I was going to faint at the chance of getting onto your show. You are one of my idols.
Oh, thank you.
So is Juan Williams and everyone else you have on your show.
Good, so I'm glad.
I'm just going out of my mind here. I recently read Bonfire of the Vanities, lying in a bed. When it first came out, I was in Somerville, Massachusetts. I was suffering from my first MS attack, which we didn't know it was MS at the time, but I was just in severe sciatic pain, and I had to take my mind off it somehow, and Tom Wolfe did that service for me, so I'm grateful to him for that then. Then I married my husband, who was nice at the time. He stuck with me through the MS attack, and we actually did get married, but then he kind of became a mini master of the universe in the medical research world. And we're no longer married, obviously. but, you know, just, and then Kathy, I think, is your book reviewer who's on today. She mentioned the scene in the book where he tries to explain what he does to the children, and it sounds absurd, right? And that's why I went from trying to dabble in those circles myself. I wrote cases at Harvard Business School, and then when we moved to Missouri, I worked for a medical publishing company and tried to be in the world of these mini masters of the universe. And you know what? Now I live in Thetford Center, Vermont. got my I went back to school and got my teaching certificate to teach preschool. And you don't even have to pay me to do that on a daily basis because children see right through everything. And, you know, I can just laugh about my ex-husband and his attempts to be a mini Sherman because I just go into the preschool and, you know, I speak their language and
All right, Maura, I'm so glad you called. I hope you stay well and stay centered with those kids. But that's exactly the point.
Well,
those kids see right through.
They see right through, and they see right through all that pompousness, which all of these characters have to a great degree, or most all of these characters. They're simply pompous creatures, pompous beings, and they don't, that's what's funny. That's because you're pricking, Wolf does it all the way through, pricks the bubble in them all, and finally gets them. And they're bullies. That's what you usually are if you're pompous. You're a bully, too.
Let's go to Vicki here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to preface my comments. I worked as a corporate lawyer during the 80s and then decided to do something different. So I became a public defender in Los Angeles County also during the 80s. And when I read the book, which was while I was working at the public defender's office, I was just struck, first of all, of course, about the corporate world and how well Tom Wolfe captured that. But the parts of the book that really stood out for me had to do with the interaction of the protagonists with the criminal justice system. And I was wondering if your guests could address that, because I've really found from working in the courts in Los Angeles that Tom Wolfe had just captured the drama, but also the futility of the whole system, and kind of with making the protagonist going in and out of the system. I thought that was also quite indicative of, you know, how things never really get resolved.
Mm-hmm.
People don't get rehabilitated. You know, a lot of money is wasted, and things just kind of go around in circles. But also just the circus nature of what goes on in the criminal courts. Thank you.
Well, I want you to know that when you said you had gone out to Los Angeles to work in the criminal justice system, William Cohen was applauding. What do you think of this?
Well, I think, again, it is another extraordinarily well-drawn portrait. The new book that I'm working on is about the criminal justice system and the flaws in it and the circus nature of it. And again, you know, I am writing, you know, 25 years later, and 25 years earlier, he sort of captures that hysteria, the futility of it, the fact that, you know, you never really know what happens or what can happen or what truth is or what justice is, and the ability of wealth to manipulate the system and people, you know, again, that idea of district attorneys doing things for political gain, it's just remarkable.
Does Tom Wolfe know men better than he knows women?
I think he knows them much better. At the same time, just much better, but they don't have the power back then. I think, as Juan was saying earlier, they were something else back then on the whole.
Appendages.
There were appendages. Yet he can do it. I mean, he's got them having some of the very few insights at all. For instance, the Larry Kramer, the guy, the wannabe prosecutor, the wannabe rich man, power, and wants also to be the lover of this woman,
with
juror.
Brown lipstick.
Right. With brown lipstick, the lover of the woman with brown lipstick, who's a juror. And he takes her to dinner. This is huge for him. He doesn't have any place to take her after dinner, but he takes, and he's married, and he's got a brand new baby at home. Still, he finally gets up the nerve. They sit and they talk, and he talks and talks. And this woman has one of the funniest, best lines in the whole thing. She says, "I sit there, and it always takes some, you know, I go and it's my career first for 2 or 3 hours." And then she is out. She didn't want to marry the man. I mean, she is out there. She would like to go to bed with him. and all he can do is talk about, and he thinks he's so important, he could just talk, my career, which is what he does and what they care about most. But also the wife, Judy of Sherman McCoy, when they're coming home from the second dinner party where he sees himself as a social lion because he's been jailed, because they all, you know, they love him.
He's gone to jail.
And they're hanging on his every word. And that's since the first time he was so shunned, he loves it. And he's going home and he tells her, well, you know, they're fine. These are fine people. And she says, it takes so little to please you.
Whoa.
You're so easy. And the women are the only ones that really can nail it.
Let's go to Chris in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been a big fan of Tom Wolfe ever since I read The Right Stuff. I live in North Carolina. I knew fighter pilots, as I was growing up. Fighter pilots were fathers or friends of mine, so I could see a lot of that. I actually saw a little bit of that in The Great Santini by Pat Conroy. I lived in New York and worked as both a photographer and as a courier during the whole bonfire period of time. And I would run into Wall Street training firms. I'd run into law firms. I'd occasionally even go to police precincts. So I ran into a lot of people who were like that. And you could kind of if you're a good observer of society, you can kind of look at a person, maybe size them up in a couple of minutes. I loved how Wolf was able to do that with a lot of the characters, some of which he would go into great depth with. And then the more you spent time with those folks, as I did occasionally, going out and drinking with them and stuff like that, which is actually how I met a person who was not in the Wolf books, but in books written by Jay McInerney and Bret Easton Ellis, who surfaced years later in the whole John Edwards drama. I met Lisa Druck in New York. And obviously, she just, she was a tragic figure, even in real life. Read the books. It was wild. And years later, it was about December 30th, 2006, when John Edwards was doing his whole thing in North Carolina. He was, we knew he was going to run for president. When I saw Lisa Druck, now Rielle Hunter, as a videographer, as a blogger, and is when I saw the Edwards campaign staff treating her like she was the cheerleader girlfriend of the high school quarterback, I bailed. I got the hell out of there. I wouldn't want nothing to do with this. This train was going to go off the tracks. The bus was going to head off the cliff.
So you were prescient as well, Juan. You were covering the whole
You know, it's different incarnations of sort of the master of the universe theme, male ego run unbounded. You know, and must say, for in honor to Tom Wolfe, you know, he's tried to do this now over subsequent books. He did Bonfire in the 80s. Then he did Atlanta Real Estate with a book called Man A Man in Full back in the 90s. Then he did I Am Charlotte Simmons, which is about kind of hookup sex on college campuses and the new ethos there.
That's the book he came through here on.
And now he's got a book out about kind of, Kate and I are talking about this, the art world, but also
Miami.
And also the immigration and the assimilation experience in Miami. And I'm trying to remember the name of that book. I think it's Back to Blood, which is a phrase, actually, Back to Blood, that you find in Bonfire of the Vanities.
But you know what's fascinating? Everybody in his book seems to be prejudiced.
Yeah.
Prejudice against blacks, against Jews, Irish, Italian. I mean, it's just all over the place.
The only people actually that Wolf seems to like and have less prejudice towards, well, the children certainly, but the Irish.
Yeah.
The only guys that come out even halfway good are these Irish guys. And the word that's used is that they're brave to a fault, that they're loyal and brave, and that everybody wants to be Irish, that the Italian cops become Irish if they're good enough, the Jewish cops want to be Irish, and the prosecutors. I mean, everybody in that criminal justice system. And I thought, well, this is the only ones that he doesn't just totally hate.
So this book, we all agree, carries over to this day and enriches us, informs us, helps us.
And has a message to tell us still.
Yeah.
Yeah,
still,
gosh, if you hear about the 47%, you can't help but think Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah, exactly. But this is also just one more quick thing on how it goes back the other way. Think of Dominique Strauss-Kahn went through everything McCoy did after this woman who was working in the hotel. This is not to say he didn't do a million other things even worse. However, it was just her word against this man who had had everything, and he was slapped in jail instantly when we found out later that maybe it was a little bit more involved. The whole thing.
And the book we've been talking about in this hour, The Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. We will not be doing a reader's review for December, since we'll take a short break over the holidays. Juan Williams, Kate Lehrer, William Cohen, thank you all so much.
Always good to be with you, Diane.
Very good.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurov-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.